Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We've got JB and Kirk here with us this evening. I hope that the Larianator will call in before too long. How are you, fellas?
Just fine.
Doing good.
Keep an eye on JB.
Call log and see if I see his name show up.
Okay. There's a couple items that are interesting in the news. We've been talking in the chat room about the Egypt Air plane, the Airbus A320, that did a nosedive into the Mediterranean. And there was speculation that, of course, the defense minister, or the aviation minister of the Egyptian aviation ministry, said that it had to be terrorism. Pretty aggressive of him, since we know absolutely nothing about what happened thus far at that airplane. You know, there are three basic options here. One is the single common denominator in most A320 crashes is the tail rudder problems. And it's what has caused, has brought down three before it. And this airplane veered 90 degrees left at 37,000 feet and then did a 360 to the right. The things that would cause that are a rudder malfunction. I don't know that. I just tell you that is that up to this point, that's been the common denominator. The second option is, of course, pilot suicide. Both pilots and the head of the flight crew were named Mohammed. But the pilot certainly was not a Muslim Brotherhood sympathizer. In fact, he posted articles in opposition to them and pro-Sisi. To be pro-Sisi, you have to be an absolute nincompoop. But nonetheless, he did. Pilot suicide is not likely in this case, considering the online presence of the pilot. Of course, that would leave you with an act of terrorism. But, that is far-fetched. First of all, there's no one who's claiming to have brought the airplane down. You know, if it was the Muslim Brotherhood, if it was the Islamic State, they would have been all over it, like a Muslim on a terror. But there's no indication that they did so. And if you were going to bring an airplane down, wouldn't you try to do it in a way that would make a bigger splash, so to speak, than have an airplane simply fall out of the sky for absolutely no reason in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea? So what do you think, fellas?
I think pretty reasonable to me. I mean, you're about your expertise on the rudders and stuff, but I wouldn't have a clue. But it would make sense if they would try to blow it up where there's a bigger population if they were going to do it as a terrorist.
Yeah, I can tell you one thing, that the Egyptian tourist industry, which, you know, I've been through Egypt. I've seen, everything that's worth seeing in Egypt was created by the pharaohs in ancient Egypt, and the Muslims have simply destroyed the place ever since then. And now that I know Yahweh, I would never go there to see the religious heritage of ancient Egypt, and now that I know Islam, I would never go there because of Islam. But the fact of the matter is that in Egypt, tourism, which was the lifeblood of their economy, is shuttered. After the airplane was destroyed that had the Russian tourists about 6-9 months ago, there is just nobody going to Egypt. And, you know, could you be in your right mind and board in an airplane flown by a Muslim?
No,
I wouldn't.
No.
No, not likely.
No. Insane. Now, speaking of insane, okay, fellas, I read an article that was published in the Washington Post yesterday. A comprehensive review of federal documentation was just concluded, and there is a new number one cause of our number one expense in the nation's health care budget. For years, the big three had been, in this order, number one had been accidents, primarily automobile accidents. Number two had been heart conditions. And number three, in terms of the big three most expensive health care costs in America, number three had been cancer. Mm-hmm. Okay, so with those as the big three, there is a new number one that is far and away the most expensive healthcare item in America. What do you guys think it is?
Doctor era hospitals, disease.
Pardon? Oh no, that's the next thing when I talk about is what is the largest cause of death, and you've already answered that question, so you've ruined that part of the show. No, I'm just what is the most expensive? What thing do we spend the most money on in terms of healthcare now in America? I gave you a
transgender operations.
Nope. That's despite the better ones in terms of having bathrooms by sexual preference, transgender Americans total less than 0.01% of the population.
I know. I was kidding.
I know you. What do you think?
Medical insurance.
Number one cost. Biggest expense now.
And legal fees. Legal fees.
Oh, well.
Nope. Number one cost is health care being provided to the mentally insane, the mentally disturbed, the mentally incompetent. Mental disorders.
Oh, boy.
Really?
Sure. Why not?
America has gotten to the point where mental disorders are far and away the single most expensive health care item. That's how far we've fallen.
Well, you know, the people here, and tell me about the Folsom Prison, the amount of medicine, the amount of care and the cost of that care to the prisoners is enormous.
And you know, I always had that jet chartered because it defrayed the cost of owning the airplane. And you know who the most frequent charter customer was of the jet and who paid the most for it per hour?
Somebody in the government?
Prison system. And that is because if you're a prisoner, you're not only afforded the best possible medical care, you're flown on a private jet to the best hospital there is anywhere in the country for your particular proclivity. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you were in prison for anything other than a drug charge, and if it's a drug charge, I'd just let you out. But if you're in prison for anything else, rape, murder, pedophilia, whatever it might be, and you contract an ailment that requires very extensive medical care, you're just going to die. But no, they would charter the airplane for ungodly amounts of money and have large crews accompany the prisoner to make certain that prisoner got the best possible health care. No, the reason I think it's several fold that mental disorders are the leading cause of health care down in America, and it's extraordinarily telling, is because of the fact that the leading contributor happens to be post-traumatic stress syndrome. There are 650,000 military and vets that claim to have PTSD, and they receive on average $6,000 a month in compensation, and they receive all manner of drugs and counsel. And to those that actually have the disorder, the reason they would have it is because the United States has asked them to do things that are insane. Our invasion of Iraq was counterproductive. It was insane. Our invasion of Afghanistan was insane. It was counterproductive. Our bombing of Libya, insane. Our dealings with Syria, absolutely insane. So if you're asked to do something that's insane and you see people die doing something that is counterproductive, it's going to have an effect on you. So that is it's the largest contributor. But overall, psychiatric drugs and psychiatric care is the single biggest cost in America. That tells you how far we have fallen. We have a wholly dysfunctional nesama, ability to be rational. You were the one who's already guessed as to what is, because it's related. What is the number one cause of death in America? And it used to be automobile accidents. And then it was heart conditions, and then it was cancer. It's not. Now the number one. Since we have socialized medicine, we've turned our hospitals into fledgling post offices. Yeah, the number one cause of death in America is mistakes in hospitals. Mistakes.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be somebody making a mistake in an operation. I mean, you get all these.
Oh, no, no.
The
minority of the doctors. Right. The doctors are a tiny minority of it. The problem is the healthcare workers are either they're illiterate, they don't give a hoot, whatever it may be, but their incompetence, their lack of judgment is prescribing the wrong medications, not prescribing the correct medications. Whatever it may be, their incompetence is what is now the leading cause of death in America.
Wow.
I mean, it's pretty horrific, isn't it? The combination of those two insights. Hey, did you hear that that Oklahoma?
Yes, I did.
The Republicans.
Well, I was amazed. I doubt if anything will come of it.
they did two things. One is they passed a resolution that says if you perform an abortion, that you've committed a felony. Now, the governor vetoed it. But, you know, we talked about this several shows ago. You know what the rate is? Oh, I'll just say what the rate is for women of childbearing age. What percentage of those have an abortion? And the answer is 4%. And in countries, which about half the world, a little more than half the world, abortion is legal. And in those countries where abortion is legal, on average, 4% of women have an abortion. You know what percentage of women have an abortion in those countries? There's about 100 of them where abortion is illegal.
50%.
4%.
Why is it about the same?
No, 4%. Okay, so the 4%. Same. Okay, I figured there was more.
Countries where abortion is legal, 4%, and countries where abortion is illegal. So why would all the protests against abortion be manifest? It has absolutely no
bearing,
factor whatsoever on the number of abortions. By the way, you know that the total number of abortions that have been performed since we began to keep statistics, since abortion became legal and they actually kept statistics on abortion, the average is 60 million per year, and the total now is over 3.5 billion fetuses have been aborted.
With just 4%?
Yeah, 4%.
Pregnancies? That doesn't make sense.
4% of pregnancies are aborted every year, but that's worldwide. You have a population of 7 billion, of which 3.5 billion are women. About half of those, about 1.5 billion of them, would be of childbearing age, and you have 4% of those who are having abortions collectively. That totals about 60 billion a 60 million a year, which is a total for the past 50 years of 3.5 billion.
Yeah.
You know, it's 50 to 60 billion a year. It adds up. Yeah, it adds up.
Yeah.
You know, 10 years, 60 billion a year. 10 years is 600 billion. You know, 20 years is 1.2 billion. And, you know, multiply that by 2.5, and you have the number of abortions that have occurred.
I did an interesting little find here. I'm sure you've probably noted it. Have you ever noticed how Halal Ben Shakar is actually written out with, you know, the H-A-Y-L-A-L?
Yeah.
Halal. Hey, you know, that's the opposite of Yah. Hey, it's the opposite of Yah.
Yeah, that is true.
Bowing down in religion and they're, you know, standing up with Yahweh.
Right, he is the shepherd that would lead in the opposite direction of Yah.
Yeah.
Because of the two lamed.
Yep, then I got that.
Yeah, you know. Hey, Lal, it would be that you've got two shepherd staffs, and the inverse of Yahweh, so it's the shepherd who leads in the opposite
way from
God. Yeah. Yep. Boy, I tell you what, having written Prophet of Doom and coming to know how Satan uses religion to position himself as God, I mean, Allah is Satan. But having done that, and then having written Questioning Paul, you get to see that the Lord of Christianity is also Satan, and how Satan is so successful at getting people to worship him as if he were God, and how Satan uses religion to position himself as a God to be worshipped. And it's astonishing, because most people are totally oblivious to it, because they think that that Satan wants to be worshipped as Satan in some kind of an occultist ceremony. And that is, I can guarantee you, the last place that Satan wants to be seen or known is in a sadist, satanic ceremony. He does not want to be known as Satan. He does not want to be known as ugly or horned or red or as the devil or the adversary. His whole purpose is to present himself as if he were God. And he does it in such a pathetic way. I mean, the religious counterfeits that he's created to position himself as God are so pathetic, so irrational, so ignorant. It's almost as if, because I cannot imagine that Satan is this stupid, it's almost as if Satan is saying, God, you know, you seem to be fascinated by these morons that you've created, but I'm going to show you just how stupid they are. I can create religions where I actually use my own name, where I tell the believers that I have possessed my messengers, and I will corrupt everything that you've said. They'll be eaten right out of my hand. They'll prefer to worship me as if I was God than they would be to engage in a relationship with you. I'm offering them nothing. I'm lying to them. And here you are telling the truth, offering the entire universe, and at the rate of a million to one, they're going to choose me over you.
It's astounding. But, you know, I mean, I had just kind of a quick, this is how bad it gets. I put out some pretty anti-religious notes.
Right.
You know, there's not one aspect of any note I share that's pro-religion. I mean, you know,
right.
I'm using Yahweh's words.
Right.
And I'm using his harshest words in many cases.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I get a woman gets on my page, and she tells me she's learning so much. Mm-hmm. And she starts discussing Yahweh in terms of G-D.
Mm.
And she found a Jewish mosque to attend. I said, are you out of your mind?
Wow.
There's no such thing. Okay?
Wow.
I said, let me call you. I called her, and she went on 100 miles an hour about how the Lord is calling her. And so she's going to take her grandkids to church. And I said, how anybody could read these notes I put out.
Right.
And be a magnate towards
a Jewish mosque
or a church is beyond stupid.
Yeah.
And that's what
you
deal
means.
With.
You know what mosque means in Arabic?
I really don't. I don't.
Place of frustration.
Well, yeah, I thought that's
place of frustration. And now imagine for a moment a God so insecure, God so lacking that he would so depraved that he would create a being to tell him how wonderful he was, create a being that's inferior to him to bow down to him. I mean, the whole concept of prostration to God is so incredibly demeaning, so insane right on its face.
Well, I mean, who would even want to spend time with him unless you were, you know, just, I'm afraid to die. Well, everybody dies a physical death. I mean, like, that's right. Stupid, you know. Who would want to? I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to spend an eternity with a monster.
Why
like
would
that?
You trust a God who is so insecure, so lacking, that he would create an inferior being to worship him? Why would you trust him?
I wouldn't. I wouldn't want anything to do. He's a monster for starting.
He'd be a monster. Yeah. Oh, a god that would say, "Love me, or I'm going to torture you forever in hell," would be a monster. You know, the god of the Quran is a monster. The god of Christianity, or probably Christianity, is a monster. So this, sadistic. I mean, but the god of those religions is in fact Satan.
You know, the god of Christianity is not just a monster. He's sort of like a Santa Claus type of monster.
Yeah.
In other words, I'll give you everything you want, too.
Or
you better love me.
If you're,
or
if you're good, I'll give you everything you want. If you're not good, I'm going to give you a coal, because that burns.
Santa Claus.
Yeah, just like Santa Claus. If you're good.
Yeah, whatever
you know,
that means.
Did God ever once say, if you're good, I will give you a nice gift,
cookies.
And if you're bad, I'm going to give you coal that will burn your britches?
No. No, and by the way, she wrote this big thing up after I booted her on her own page about, is this any way to save souls?
Yes.
You know, my answer
yes,
to that
is, yes,
I don't
absolutely.
Even, first of all, I don't even know how to save souls. That's not the business I'm in. I'm in the business of sharing Yahweh's words. That's in the business
look,
I'm in. I don't know how to
Yahweh
save
is in the business of saving souls. Now, he only saves his covenant members, and to become a covenant member, you
yeah,
become
he's
in that way of religion.
Yeah,
he is in that business, and he does explain how he goes about doing it. But he is extraordinarily dismissive of those who are religious.
Oh, yeah, I know.
I've just finished reviewing chapter 2. From observations for our time. I've rewritten chapters 5, 6, and 7. 1 and 2, and now I'm on, I don't know why I jumped ahead, but I'm on 4, then I'll double back to 3. There are multiple places where God just says, I cannot comprehend the religious, I can't endure being around the religious, and I can't save the religious. That's pretty indicting. The religion is so moronic. I mean, I don't understand it anymore. God says, I don't understand it. I have no idea what would cause somebody to be religious. I don't comprehend it. I don't want to understand it. I don't want to be around anybody who is religious. And there is nothing I can do or say to save the religion. So with this woman, we say, is that any way to save souls? The woman, you say, your soul isn't salvageable. The reason I stopped spending time with you is your soul is not salvageable. It cannot be saved. So, no, I'm not about this. Booting you has nothing to do with saving souls. It just was an absolute waste of my time. Until you're willing to walk away from
religion. My time is better spent elsewhere.
Absolutely.
I need to ask a question.
Yeah.
If I may.
Sure.
When you became real proficient at translating, and you knew you could trust what you were doing because you've gone through enough lexicons and so forth.
Okay, I disagree with both of those two things, but all right.
I
don't think I'm
proficient. You know what God's talking
about.
You know what
I don't trust what I'm doing. I'm always suspect.
But you felt comfortable enough to write us about it, right? So
I found what
you know, so consistent and so
compelling that I couldn't help but share what I was learning, even as I was in the process of learning it.
I've never claimed
that my translations were perfect. It's just
no, I'm not even saying that.
They make total sense to me. They're consistent with what God's with His nature and with His plan. And I find them absolutely fascinating. And so, I would say that they are probably better than any other, only because, I approach it in a
no one else tries.
Yeah, that no one else even tries. Which is that I approach them from, I got to know who Yahweh is. I got to know what He's offering, what He expects from us. And I approach every statement that He makes in a manner that knowing who He is and what He is offering and what He expects in return, let's render this using His words in a manner that is consistent with His nature and with His proposal I figure it's pretty hard to go too far astray if you do that.
Okay, now knowing okay. that, well, just at face value.
Okay.
When you go through and you read stuff, like I've been doing a lot lately, and I'm going through these translations and I'm substituting things that I know are wrong, whether it's Yahweh's name or just the simple things, and not even complicated stuff. You cannot find these guys who translate these guys who write these lexicons and so forth. It's so obvious that what we discuss all the time is absolutely 100% true,
mm-hmm.
and that religion is 100% false. I mean, it's not even close. And
religion
how,
is false.
How is it? I'm
not
saying how I the Christian didn't know this.
It's just irrational.
Yeah. But even with a little bit of perspective and a little bit of knowledge of what we're doing, you read through this stuff and you say, well, it says exactly that in every one of these Hebrew words, save two or three that you know are wrong to begin with.
Yeah.
How can someone be a translator and write these things and have not seen it?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I have found...
well, it's intentional. We know that.
Well, no, it's
intentional. It is intentional.
They're the ones that do
the
intentional things
because
people like us.
I mean, I have a perspective. I have an axe to grind. I have a, I'm motivated to convey the word of God as I know it.
That represents his nature, you mean?
Yeah, right.
Like
so I do. But one of the comforts that I have in terms of the translations
mm-hmm.
is that, for example, going through the, today and yesterday, going through my translations of the 91st Psalm. And there are so many specifics in that Psalm that were absolutely specific to my experience and that proved to be accurate relative to our relationship and my experience. That you go through that and you lay those things out and you say, you know, this is God providing 3,000 years in advance the specific game plan that we would engage in. And so there is a 0% possibility that the renderings were incorrect.
I just have such a hard time that you read it, and that's exactly what it says. I mean,
yes.
If you just translate the words, it's exactly what it says. This is, it's not a... How can they... Then when you go to the commentary, occasionally now I'm going to the commentary to see what Christians are talking about, how they interpret these things.
Yeah.
And I'm going, how the heck do you get there from here? That's not
yeah,
at all what any of these words mean. And you just look in your own dead gum lexicons.
Right. Yeah, during the time I was writing the first version of Question Paul, I spent a lot of time checking the Christian lexicons. But I want to know how in the world they got there. You know, when mm-hmm. when Paul made the statement that the covenant was presented on Mount Sinai was with Hagar and enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, since it's the absolute opposite of what God said, I want to see how in the world do Christians deal with that absolute, irrefutable, undeniable lie.
Okay.
And so I did. I spent a lot of time looking at their explanations. I just don't anymore. I mean, it just doesn't. I just don't care. The only thing I will do on occasion, and I did it in a couple of chapters here in Observations for a Time, to show how Christian publications corrupt Yahweh's testimony, I do occasionally put the New Living Translation or the King James, and I'll lay it out there and say, this is how they presented the same statement. How they get there, I can't tell you. But I can tell you I didn't write this in the chapter, but Larry, I agree with you that it's almost impossible to get there from to Yahweh by reading a book with the name on the front of the Bible. The translations are so bad.
It's killed billions of people. They should be.
Yeah, it has.
I mean,
it has.
Look, if everything that people think, they thought by accident, it would be one thing. It's pretty clear to me what that it's all been intentional. Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I can read, I don't care if it's papyrus from the second century with a witness writings, you know, where in Mat and Yod saying anyone that calls me Lord won't be entering the kingdom, you know. Or,
yeah.
Or I can.
Yeah, no one.
Or I can
Lord,
read
Lord,
these.
Lord, enter the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, or I can read
Lord,
what they call
me. I don't know you.
Yeah. Yeah,
you are Torah.
And I could. Yeah, I could, yeah, and then that becomes evildoers, which is a guy that doesn't tithe
right.
enough, or he goes
right.
to the bar
right. yeah,
or something like
right.
that.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah. Evildoer is whatever I say it is, you know. And then the other thing is, when you go to an Old Testament, you know, which is what they call it in their trashy sun goddess
mm-hmm.
book, it makes no sense at all. And that's got to be intentional, too.
Well,
you know,
when you call Yahweh God's testimony, and you've got this corrupt version of it,
old.
And you,
yeah.
And where you have, like I wrote in the second chapter, I think, listed the five things that collectively in Bibles were the worst thing that humankind can do. I mean, first of all, to begin to label the book with Baal. Based upon Babel, the Hebrew word to corrupt and to confuse. I mean, you start there. And then you, with Babel meaning with the Lord, you change Yahweh's name 7,000 times from Yahweh to the Lord. And then you label his Torah, Nabi, and Mizmor, his Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, you label them an Old Testament. And then you create a New Testament, and you add it to the book that half of which is written by the plague of death, and it's wholly and completely contradictory. And it's the New Testament, and you add that to it, and then you deliberately corrupt the translations. You put all those things together, and what you end up with is something that is far more deadly than it is beneficial.
Well, yeah, I mean, I had a person ask me, how do you know these translations are correct? Okay, I mean, I can appreciate where they're coming from.
Uh-huh.
And all they're doing, they're slinging around a KJV and a Strong's. And I'm going to tell
right.
you, that ain't going to make it. It ain't
going to
make
it. No, it ain't going to make it. It ain't going to make it.
And when I show, you know, what I do is you know, the translation where you do in Psalm, the Mizmor 119:164,
mm-hmm.
where it says, you know, Shaba,
right.
during the day, Baha Yom, Halal,
right.
radiate
right.
your light. So
right.
seven is the promise because Sheba and
right.
means
right.
promise. Shaba means seven. Seven is the promise
right.
during the day.
Right.
I mean, Yom, everybody's heard of Yom Kippurim, Yom
right.
Teruah.
Right.
You know, that's a day.
Right.
And Halal means to radiate your light. Then we go down here,
right.
and what does our little Biblia say? Seven times a day I praise you for your righteous laws. Well, first of all, the word praise isn't there.
No.
We always know they call Sadak righteous, and we always know they
right.
call Torah laws, all words that aren't even in the actual script.
Right.
So, you know, why does anybody have to guess whether their Biblia is trash? And why?
And all you have to do on the King James is to look at its history. Why did it come into being? It came into being for a specific reason, and that is that King Hiram was threatened by the fact that the Geneva Bible had become extraordinarily popular, and that it had footnotes which pointed out the irrefutable conclusion that God's not only opposed to government, that he hasn't authorized any king. The only king that God actually authorized was Dodd. There hasn't been one before Dodd, nor one after Dodd. And so the King Iams had a conniption fit that the Geneva Bible was undermining his claim to have been authorized by God to rule over the people. And so the King Iams, King James Bible, came into existence for a purely political reason.
Solely
there wasn't a single Hebrew scholar on the team. There wasn't any access to a Hebrew text. There was the product was not a wholesale translation from the Textus Receptus or from any other Greek manuscript, the entire project was to revise the Geneva Bible such that it no longer suggested that the king wasn't authorized by God. And so all it is a revision five times over of a really reckless translation of the Latin Vulgate, which was a translation of the Septuagint third century manuscripts. In fact, already translated into Latin. It has absolutely no credibility. And to say, well, it was authorized by whom?
Yeah.
Authorized by whom?
One man authorized other men.
Right.
Yeah, well, I've actually had people ask me for my credentials. Credentials?
What?
Are you kidding me? You know, yes. I mean, Yahweh, he didn't Yahusha, these people claim to follow Yahusha, you know, most of them, I sure.
I know. Yeah.
And didn't he say these scribes are a bunch of lowlife pricks?
Right.
I mean, that's what he said. And
hey,
how
were most of these credentials?
It's a sheeper.
He was a stutter and a sheeper. What were those credentials? He was a rock slinger and a sheepherder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What were Abraham's credentials?
He was
what were Noah's credentials?
They all had the same credential. They were all willing to listen to Yahweh. The only credential they had.
You know, I just finished rewriting the introduction to the fourth chapter, which is a review of the 91st Psalm. And so when God said, I've got a job to do, and I accepted that job, it wasn't because I had any credentials. I had none. I still have none. I mean, the only thing that makes a person valuable in terms of sharing what Yahweh is offering, who he is, what he's offering, what he expects in return, is a willingness to listen to him and to go where the words lead. I mean, that's it. There is no other credential. I mean, I would say, I have the ultimate credential. So do you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a member of the covenant.
Right.
That's the ultimate credential. That is the club of clubs, the ultimate fraternity. Doesn't get better than that. That's my credential. I'll hang that out, that's my credential. I'm a member of the covenant. I don't think you guys have any other.
No.
As a matter of fact, I was kind of going through with what freedom of the Torah is. Last night.
Most liberating book in the world.
And I was explaining that the religious concept is that, you make sacrifices, you might be paying tithes, you're out helping the poor, you're doing all these sacrifices that are necessary to somehow earn your salvation. Well, we're told not to do the work of the Malacca. I mean, there's no way we could anyway, but, I mean, we're told not to.
Yeah, like you're saying, you're not in the business of salvation. I'm not in the business of salvation either. In fact, I am really uninterested in helping somebody save their soul. I know Yahweh. I enjoy his company. We have a common interest. We enjoy the same thing. I find it interesting to learn more about him and to share what I've learned. If that isn't good enough for you, then I've got nothing to talk about. I've got nothing to talk about. Yeah, it's nothing to talk about. And that's all that I want to talk about. I want to say, here is who he is. This is what he's offered. This is what he expects in return. This is what he likes. This is what he dislikes. And, if that's of interest to you, great. You know, he proves his existence. He is worth knowing. I rather like him.
Yeah, and if it's not great, that too. Have at it, or don't have at it, because, that's what free will is all about. There's no commands, there's no lightning bolts being thrown at you.
The Torah is an extraordinarily liberating document. There's no laws, no obey. And the poster boy for observing the Torah, for being Torah observant, was really a flawed individual goat. And if so, if a guy that had, in particular, I mean, if you look at Dode, I mean, he had lots of hang-ups. But his biggest thing was, I mean, that boy had a real thing for women. I mean, he liked the girls. And if you can be as promiscuous as Dode, and so much so that you're the first seven kids you have all have different mothers, and it doesn't get much better after that. You know, you've got so many women in your harem that you don't even know all their names. And yet, God's going to say, you're right, man. You are one righteous dude. I am so enamored with you, I'm going to call you beloved. When I return to earth, I'm going to establish my kingdom on earth in the manner of our relationship. I don't know how you get more liberating than that.
Right. I mean, all we're doing is understanding and giving credit due where the credit's due. That's what setting, you know, these dates aside are. They're for the purpose of understanding. They're not for the purposes of worship. They're not for the purposes of a religious ritual. They're not for anything but really understanding and giving credit where it's due. You know, and saying, look, I'm smart enough to know that. Well, we're
seeing that credit where credit is due. Well, I agree with that. I don't see God, in terms of his children, the covenant, expressing his authority or superiority.
No, I don't either, but we do understand the plan.
I understand that what he designed was an extraordinary plan, extraordinarily beneficial, caring, giving, nurturing, beneficial. But even as extraordinary as he is in terms of brilliance, in terms of generosity in the plan and what he is offering, I see him as extraordinarily approachable, down to earth. I see him more as someone you want to spend time with because you share the same, you enjoy the same things. I enjoy what he enjoys, so I want to spend time with him. But it's not in a sense of awe. It's really just a very comfortable, this is my absolute favorite individual in the world. And so I want to spend time because we enjoy the same things. But, you know, I was rewriting the introduction to, as I said before, and when Yahweh first approached, I had an aversion to authority. I still have an aversion to authority. Well, God's the ultimate authority. I don't have any aversion to him. And it's because with his children, he doesn't approach his children as an authority. He's really very approachable, comfortable to be around, very friendly. It's hard to put the term humble in association with something as magnificent as God, but he really is, doesn't have an ego.
Pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing. And it's very comfortable. And he is very patient with us. And I think, I was babysitting today our little granddaughter. And she's not capable of talking now. She understands expressions, but she doesn't understand language. And she can't crawl or walk. She is totally and completely dependent, and you spend all this time, and it's fun to be around her, but you can't have very high expectations. I mean, her attention span is about that of a goldfish, and she simply responds to very simple kinds of things, like expressions and tone of voice. But how different really is that between us and Yahweh? And yet he's patient and entertained by it, just as I was entertained to love our little granddaughter. Can't wait for the next experience. I think it's quite similar. You can't view yourself as high and mighty and enjoy that kind of experience. You really have to just get down to what's important, what's enjoyable. And and that explains what's enjoyable and what's important to Yahweh. He has something he wants to share, and he wants to share it with us. And he wants to spend time doing the same thing for us as I was doing with my little granddaughter. Now, I think that the gap between myself and a seven-month-old is much narrower than the gap between us and Yahweh. But that doesn't stop him from enjoying every moment of it. And ultimately, he's going to narrow that gap. So it is a marvelous I guess the thing that is so perplexing to me is when you consider just how good God is, just how extraordinary he is, how approachable he is, how generous his offer is, how little he expects of us and how much he's willing to give us, how clear and consistent he's been in his testimony, and how obvious it is that man's alternatives in politics and religion and militarism are counterproductive, irrational, moronic. Why is it that for every million people on the earth, only one of those million chooses to accept what Yahweh is offering, and the rest choose to embrace that which is obviously false and counterproductive?
Well, you know, they have so many physical ideas about it, for one thing, which is really hypocritical. You know, when you went to churches, you used to hear them talk, well, the Jews were looking for a physical Messiah, and he's a spiritual Messiah, right? I mean, that's what you used to hear. And yet, they have to have the zombie Jesus get up and walk. They can't understand. And they're worried about where bodies are buried and, you know, nonsense like this. It's the ultimate hypocrisy, really. You know, because
right.
We all know a physical body can't become a spiritual being. I mean, it just cannot happen. It's definitely not going to happen.
The very premise of Christianity is in conflict with reason.
But you know, we have that whole era of 400 years. 400 years, where not one person on the planet listened to Yahweh.
Correct.
I mean, we should be amazed that one in a million do overall.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah, I was looking for someone who couldn't find anyone. And I think it was actually longer than 400 years. You know, he clearly had a period of time as Yosha where he found 12 fellows who were willing to listen to him. And those fellows reached out to others, and there were more who were willing to listen to him. But it didn't take long for the world to go right back to where it was during that 400-year chasm. Where I think there was a long period of time, from probably around 200 CE to fairly recently, where you'd have to look hard to find anyone who knew it.
You know, and that's what I said. You know, it's astounding what we're actually doing as a group. You know, putting the words together, sharing the words, getting them out. And in numerous different ways, different people doing it. This has not been done in thousands of years.
No. No, it really hasn't been done since Yosha did it. And, in the early first century CE. I don't think it's been done.
Isn't that astounding? I mean, it's really kind of astounding to be a part of that. I mean, I'm really...
Yeah, it is.
I'm
it
astounded.
Is. Yeah. But I think we've all predicted. I think we're a lot of the prophecies we've considered have it this way, and it is what you would expect. I mean, we're nearing the ultimate decision point. You know, there is coming a point where God's going to say, "That's it. Everybody's had the opportunity. I'm not allowing any more choice. You're either on one side or the other." And the only thing that Yahweh is actually waiting for, if you can say waiting. I mean, he's not waiting because he's going to return on Yom Kippur. I mean, you're 6,000 Yah, so it's in the seventh dimension. That is yesterday, just as easily as it is tomorrow. I mean, so there's no real patience on his part. But the plan that he outlined was designed so that he could come full circle. That the people that he chose and the promises that he made to Abraham, to Yitzhak and Jacob, that he could honor them. So it was essential that there would be some individuals who would collectively band together, who would share in written and audible form what Yahweh had to say about this covenant relationship, so that it would be possible for his children to be reconciled unto him prior to his return, because those Yehuda and Yisrael, circa 2033, year 5999, they will have had to have done it about face. They will have had to have come to know, to accept, and to act upon Yahweh's terms and conditions for the covenant prior to his return, or they would be annihilated upon his return. Mm-hmm. So you have to think, well, for that to be the case, how do they get the information? Because can you name a time where God said, you know, I'm not going to work through people. What I'm going to do is I'm going to deliver this message all on my own. I'm just going to stand there 500 feet tall, and I'm going to be, you know, in blaze orange right in front of everybody, and I'm not going to convey my message through humans. I'm just going to, which is the prime directive, I'm not going to work with fellow man. I'm just going to do this on my own. Do you find any examples of that?
None.
And so it was incumbent upon Yahweh, based upon his style, his nature, his character, and his purpose, to find someone, find people, individuals, who were willing to listen to it, who were willing to investigate what he had to say and to share it. Because his plan is to reconcile his covenant relationship with Yehuda and Yisrael in year 6000 Yah, and for that to occur, either God has to deliver that message himself, or he has to have individuals take the time to correctly convey what he has promised, and then to share that in a way that his children can read it.
Well,
those are it. And so we have been offered that distinction, that opportunity. Now, you know, that's not, you know, as I wrote in this chapter, because I'm rewriting chapter 4, that's not meant to be an honor. It's not a reward. It's not a trophy. It's not something to say, ho, 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 aren't we special? No. The bottom line is that not one of us is qualified. Not one of us is perfect. Not one of us has earned or deserves this distinction. The only reasons we have it are twofold. No one else was willing, and we were willing. Now that's a big part of it, just free will. We were willing, and more importantly, we were also willing to go where his words led, no matter what.
No matter what.
Things, yeah, no matter what. No matter what.
Yeah, and who cares? I mean, all we were doing was trampling over religious precepts that were lies anyway. Who cares? I mean, really.
At the time that it began, it was troubling to me. And I think that anybody who is new to the covenant, it is troubling to them. It's a bit disorienting. It's a bit isolating. And once you have been there, it becomes liberating and enlightening. And so, you know, you were correct. Now, knowing what we gave up and how foul it is, it's like taking a shower. You know, when I take a shower, the dirt that is that I am washing away isn't something that has any benefit. It's good to be gone. It's good to be to rid of it. That's the same thing about religion and politics. It was good to be rid of it. But we were given this opportunity because we were not only willing to take it, but we were willing to go where the words led. And as for being willing to share them, I actually don't think there is any other option. We're not compelled to share them. We're not forced to show them. We don't feel an obligation to share them. You just can't help it. I mean, it's just literally, it's like having a child. If you're a good parent, you want to share everything you know and have learned and experienced with your child. You know, if you find something that is extraordinary, you actually gain, you benefit, you grow, you're enriched by sharing it.
So it may be because, it may be because I'm a teacher that I just, when you hear something, you go, did you know about this? Because when I read Yada Yada, I'd go around showing them how to spell Yawa.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help it. I mean, I didn't do it because it was someplace in Yada Yada that says, go do this. I just said, this is really cool. Did you know this?
This is really cool. Yeah, it's really cool. Everything you learn is exciting. It's cool. It's fun. It's rewarding.
One of the things I was talking about there is we don't have sacrifices to make. He doesn't ask for our sacrifice. And not at all.
Today, for example, our good friend Scott needed to get out of Dodge. You know, there's just some days where you're just not comfortable, and somebody says something, who knows what it was. I didn't press him on it. But, he said, I'm going to stay here for the observation show, but, just today it's just not a great day. And so what I told Scott is, get out of there. Just go. We'll do it another day. The approach that I think you have to what we're doing is, if it's not fun, if you don't want to do it because you enjoy doing it, then don't do it. And, and if there's days that, and there sometimes there are, life gets in the way and it's a burden for whatever reason, do it another day. God is not demanding of us. He's not saying, boy, here there was nobody else here. I spent all this time with you. I gave you this opportunity and you're a derelict on the job. No, that's not his approach at all. I spent several hours today playing grandpa. I did not feel guilty that I wasn't completing chapter 4. No, it's part of life and part of living. This is not a burdensome job.
No, it's not. It's the best part of life. But what I was going to say is there's another facet to it. It's not just that we're not required to make sacrifices, because we're not. Not at all. The interesting thing to me is that, when we start getting into the dulled implement part of it, the Dodes, the Abrahams.
Right, flawed, dirty, and all that.
And whoever. the Moshe's. One thing we do know, what we do know is that we don't have to be perfect. We can be the flawed implement.
The rest of the world runs around
with a PR man in a movie.
Yahweh only has two conjugations, two tenses in the sense of verbs. There's the perfect and the imperfect. And Yahweh's entire lexicon is designed to perfect the imperfect.
That's
to make the imperfect
perfect. I never thought of that. Yeah, I never even thought of that.
Right. And, the imperfect present, that's our ongoing nature, our habitual nature. Well, the perfect is it's complete and totally done. He perfects the imperfect. I mean, just the conjugations in Hebrew describe the entire plan. The Torah exists to perfect the imperfect.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I was constantly
struggling with, why were so many things written in the imperfect? And you start, imperfect, well, that means flawed. Well, why would God's terminology convey something that's flawed? Imperfect, right? Mm-hmm. And the imperfect is used far more than the perfect in Hebrew in terms of shaping the verbs. It just dawned on me, like this last week. The whole purpose is to perfect the imperfect. The Torah was written, the Old Testament was written on behalf of the imperfect to make us perfect. That's the whole purpose of the whole thing. Of course,
there's like 20 million ways to come back, and this is just another one. Yeah, I'm hearing that, really.
Yeah, that's who he's talking to. And of course, the very fact that there's a perfect and imperfect, and that that almost all human behaviors are written in the imperfect, it tells you that the Pauline myth that the Torah is a set of laws, and if you're guilty of violating one of them, you have been condemned by all of them. That's the exact opposite of the language itself. The language says, no, I'm writing this to the imperfect for the purpose of perfecting you. That's the
astounding. Yeah, I mean, that's an astounding insight, and it's something nobody else has ever said. I've never heard this before, but that's right.
Didn't even think of it until just this week. But one of the things, you know, when I was a Christian, I would constantly talk about how, you know, the more we give to God, you know, our shovel is just smaller than his shovel, that he always gives us back more than we give to him. I'm thinking, you know, now that we're part of the covenant, I like to refer to myself as a dented flawed implement because, you know, it's a dented flawed implement being used in a perfect hand. But I ain't shoveling anything his way.
No, you're not. You don't have to.
Anything his way.
Yeah.
And I know.
Yeah, I mean, if you were paying a tithe, you'd be outside the Torah.
That's
you'd
right.
be screwing up if you were right. doing that.
Yeah. God's real clear. Can't buy him. Can't buy his love.
I mean, tithe was never money. It was always food.
All
I'm
offering God is
that didn't exist.
That's all I'm offering him is companionship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this idea that, you know, when somebody would write and say, I want to thank you for, you know, your dedication and all the work that you do in providing these translations. I'm not giving that to God. God gets absolutely no benefit whatsoever by the time that I spend studying his testimony. I get the benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Benefit is all mine. Yeah, it's all mine. I mean, you think that he gained something by me telling him what he said?
What is
he
missing?
Makes him happy.
That's a way to put it. But I think he wants us trumpeting his word.
But
here's why.
He
enjoys it, but am I giving him anything by translating and sharing his words? No, I'm not giving him anything.
Yes,
in a way, you know, your relationship with him grows, and he grows through that relationship.
It's relationship. That's it.
So
that's just a relationship with you.
Yeah, I was dealing with the end of the 91st Psalm.
But it's not just a relationship.
God was explaining why. God was explaining why he valued me. By the way, we all know the 91st Psalm is written for every one of Yahweh's children. I'm going to make it personal because it is personal to me. It should be personal to every one of us. And God was explaining why he valued me. And you know what's the number one reason why he, well, it was two reasons he had. And I'm going to share both reasons. But one of the two reasons is
we enjoyed
the same things.
Well, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he actually didn't say. I mean, he has two things that he says is the reason that he valued our relationship, and one of the two is that we enjoy the same things. We enjoy learning. We enjoy experiencing things together. So we enjoy the same things. You know, when you pick your friends, don't you pick your friends based upon common interests?
Mm-hmm.
We enjoy the same things. The second is that I rewrote this translation because it was important to get the verb tenses conveyed properly in English, knowing that I have the full range of opportunities in English because the Hebrew affords, you know, a verb that is not constrained by time. And part of it was, and of course this was Yada, my Shem. So what I recognized at the time that he shared that with me, I didn't know what his name was. But if you write it correctly, it's the other reason that I was important to him is that he said he's going to come to know my name. He's going to literally understand and be able to properly convey my name. And then he's going to do it. Now, John wrote his name 7,000 times in the single most frequently highly published document of all time, the Torah Prophet Song. Nothing in human history has been published as frequently as that, and he wrote his name 7,000 times in it. And there's only 22 letters, and all four letters in his name are vowels, and they are amongst the most common letters in the Hebrew language. You wouldn't think that would be a big deal. But I'm going to tell you, before we came to systematically understand Yada, Yahweh, there wasn't anybody out there conveying his name. Now there are a bunch of people out there. You can go online, you'll find hundreds, if not thousands, of sites with Yahweh. But, that was a big deal. Big deal to God. It was a big enough deal to God that God said, from my perspective, you're important. That's pretty cool. Now, I'm not important among men, but I'm important to God for that reason. That's pretty good. I'll take that any day. It doesn't mean deadly squat to my dog, but it means something to you. And, Larry, you were mentioning this before, but I think before we engaged in this endeavor, had you seen anyone, any place you had read, what the specific purpose was of each of the seven steps that comprised the Moed Mikra, or how the first four had been fulfilled because they provide the five benefits of the covenant?
No, not at all. I met a couple people that understood the first four had been, fulfilled, obviously, but none of them understood the purposes of the first four. I remember you asking me, and I just thought, the fall Moed is designed, to coincide with the fall of man, which is true, that's true.
Now, I agree that there were, I had run across one or two people that said, okay, the first four have been fulfilled.
But they didn't know why.
But they didn't know what they represented.
No, they didn't know it took away the sin of death, which is what Moshe said.
Enoch represents the doorway to life.
Right.
I don't think I've read any place else where matzah represents the means to
perfecting us. Yeah.
Right. So that once we become perfect and immortal, and by the way, they are coterminous. Pesach is matzah. Matzah is Pesach. On Pesach, one eats matzah. They are coterminous. And once you become perfect and immortal, then you are in a position to be adopted by Yahweh. And once you're adopted into the covenant, God's in a position where he can provide you with the benefits of the covenant, which are to enrich and empower you. Those are the first four mikra. And have they been fulfilled in the sense of, yes, Passover, the dress rehearsal for Passover came twice. Abraham on Mount Moriah with Yishak and the sacrificial lamb being there. And Yahweh said, I'll provide this sacrifice. Here's my son. And then with the Exodus where the religious and political and military institution of Egypt was killing the children of Israel and enslaving them. And Yahweh said, I'm going to show you the doorway to life. Here it is. And I'm going to show you the consequence of not participating, availing yourself of this doorway to life. I'm going to kill the firstborn sons of all those who do not participate, who do not avail themselves of it. And so this is the doorway to life. And then you realize that yeast is a fungus. And that Yosha specifically said that what I'm talking about here when I'm talking about yeast is political and religious rebellion, and that that's what's being removed, and how that is what makes us perfect so that we can be firstborn children. I mean, that's what Bakuda means, is firstborn children, that we can be the children born into the first family. And then Shavuot is the promise of the Shabbat, the promise of seven, where we are specifically empowered and enriched. I mean, it is a marvelous presentation. And then you look at the fulfillment of Shavuot is exactly when Yahweh revealed the Torah to Moshe. That's when they were at Mount Horeb. You know, 7 times 7 days after they left.
Yeah, that's the foreshadowing. That's right. And then they had the fulfillment. I got a whole note on foreshadowings and fulfillments. You clearly see all the foreshadowing straight out of Yahweh's words. You see all the fulfillments right out of Yahweh's words.
Yeah. And is there any place where Yosha said, you know, this fulfillment of Shavuot, we're now going to call Pentecost because, you know, I've decided that I like Greek better than I like Hebrew. And so we're going to ignore the fact that I speak of it as Shavuot, and it's the promise of the Shabbat and my testimony, and we're going to rename it Pentecost. And then, because, you know, I just really love this pagan language of Greek. And then what we're going to do is we're saying, you know, it has nothing to do with being empowered and enriched. It's going to be the birth of the church. Or did when they celebrated the Shavuot, was instead the benefit of Shavuot that those who had availed themselves of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim were now empowered and enriched with the testimony of Yahweh so that they could share what they had come to know with the world. Isn't that what the eyewitness accounts say?
Yeah.
And, you know, they became the living embodiment of Teruah. As we are now, the living embodiment of Teruah. Now, so we are literally, in my view, we're fulfilling Teruah as we speak. Now, there is another fulfillment of Teruah where Yahweh will harvest us, but we're engaged in the process of Teruah now. And I think that the purpose of our Teruah, you get right back to what are we doing here? Why us? What are we accomplishing here? What does Teruah lead to? Yom Kippurim, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the purpose of Yom Kippurim?
Reconciliation. Reconciliation.
With whom?
Sure. With her family. With
Yehuda
and
Israel.
And Yisrael.
Right. That is correct. I'm not Jewish.
No.
I'm not Jewish. I don't think you guys are either.
No.
Not principally. Not
I might
primarily.
Have some in me way back, but not that I know of.
I'm not primarily, but I certainly, we were German Jews, Hendricksmeyer.
Yeah.
No question about that.
All right. So, but the purpose of Yom Kippurim is, it tells us that on Yom Kippurim what's going to happen. He's going to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and Yehuda. And so the purpose that we're engaged in now of Teruah is to facilitate Yahweh's reconciliation with his children. And I'm here to tell you, God's not willing to do that on his own. God is not willing to hover above Yisrael and say, all you numbskulls, it's time that you listen to me, and here's what I have to say, and, you know, I'm going to return on this day, and if you don't figure it out and change allegiances between now and then, you're toast. No, he doesn't.
I did a thing on free will this week, and I said, one of the things about calling mitzvah commands, you had brought up that he's asking you to seriously consider, and that's a good insight. So I use that. But
right.
I said further than that, nobody has ever thrown lightning bolts at my feet and told me to do anything.
Yeah. Hey,
I'm a creature of free will.
You ever been told that it's your responsibility to read the U.S. tax code?
Yeah.
Yes. right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, I got
you're
three
okay
lifetimes.
That, right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, in fact, you're a
we all commit perjury.
Have you ever been told that we're
in
compliance with the U.S. Constitution?
What did you say?
Have to read it. You ever been told that you have to read the U.S. Constitution?
No. No, I haven't, actually.
No, you've never been told you have to read the U.S. Constitution. But you, right, but you're expected to comply with it, aren't you?
That's right. Yeah.
Both. You're expected to comply with it.
My leaders don't have to.
Right. So, but you've never been given an instruction by your government that you should shamar.
Nope.
Closely examine and carefully consider these documents. The moment that Yahweh told us that we should shamar Torah, shamar mitzvah, shamar mishpat, closely examine and carefully consider, it removed them from being considered laws. Laws are not to be considered.
They're to be followed.
Yeah,
to be obeyed.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's the law. You comply or there's going to be consequences. It has nothing to do, if you go to the judge, let's say that you did not properly obey the law of 25 miles an hour in the school zone, and you were going 50. And you go to the judge and you say, you know, judge, I have closely examined and carefully considered the law pertaining to the speed in a school zone, and based upon my analysis of that law and those who compose that law and those that it benefits and restricts, it's my interpretation that my going 50 was actually a reasonable expression of my interpretation of that law. How is that going to work for you in front of that judge?
Not going to work.
Not going to work. So I don't care how well how closely you've examined or carefully you've considered the law, you're either in violation of it or you're not. No. Yahweh's instructions.
Of course, that's why they got to have Shamar Obey or Shema Obey. They have to have it like that because then you're obeying the command. You know, I've had people tell me that. I had one guy tell me, well, you know, and this is, you know, he was a subscriber to Dante's Hell, you know, which I find really stupid. Because, you know, how do you burn a spiritual being? I mean, I don't even know how that works. But
and how can hell be a lightless place? And you're going to
have fire at the same time. I agree. Yeah, but they don't consider that part. Of course, they don't even think that part. But he told me that the reason that there's a hell was how else could why would we obey Yahweh's commands if he couldn't throw us in hell? I mean, this guy really thought he was part of thinking process there. I said, man, I said, you learn that shit in Sunday school? I mean, really, that's deep, man. You want to go back to the Baptist church and teach for a while.
And I am inspired by his instructions. I am enlightened by his teaching. I've grown by his guidance. I observe his testimony because I find it rewarding. That's why I do it. You know, a God who would say, you either obey me or I'm going to torture you forever in hell, isn't somebody I want to spend any time around. It would be a monster.
No, clearly.
Straight up monster. It's amazing that people can't think their way through the process. But, you know, you also look at so many of the other things that we've come up with. I don't think I've read any place where it talks about the five terms and conditions or the five benefits of the covenant, but they're there. They're clear.
Okay.
They're irrefutable. Sure.
Can I interject a little thing for a moment? Before I met you, I had accumulated probably one of the greatest collections of theological books and things from my grandfather and family. I would get all the books. And I started about a year prior to running across I started reading them. I figured, surely God's got to be in there somewhere so I can figure all this out.
Yeah.
So I know it sounds stupid now, but that was my go-to.
Yeah.
So I went through all this, and I did a pretty good dent in all of it. I read a lot. and nothing that you said for the last 12, 15 minutes is there.
No,
this is. There's not a preacher in America that wouldn't love to have that collection of books I have. The only reason I don't sell them is I don't want to spread it. It's like spreading a disease, you know. So, but it's.
Yeah, I remember when I used to lead Bible studies, the first thing I would do, because if you're in a Bible study, you're always talking about Paul's letters. And I had Barclay's commentary, and I would always read the several pages of Barclay's commentary and then make the presentation. Oh, man, I was considered to be enlightened. And, oh, yeah, that was really hot stuff. And the sad thing was, as I was presenting and presenting, God, I'm just an absolute fraud. What I'm saying here doesn't make any sense. What in the world am I doing? And these people are just so blown away, impressed, and oh my goodness, this is awful. And you know, you deal with the conflicts, and you can't explain them, so you just have to whisk them away. I mean, for example, how many places have you heard that the reality is that there was no bodily resurrection? That A, God did not die, and there was no bodily resurrection, and that.
That was it. You figured that one out, and we've spread that. I mean, I've got three notes on just that. You know, how do you fulfill 3 days when you're dead in the tomb? For one thing, you know, going back to the cardia, as it was written.
Right. Yeah, the heart of the
fulfilling the three moed mikra, you can't be dead while you're doing it. And in the psalm, it clearly says, "You did not give me over to death." And it describes something far worse than being crucified, as a matter of fact.
Right. Yeah. You know? Why would they, even the eyewitness accounts, have, my God, why have you forsaken me? If, in fact, God died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It's all very logical the first time somebody puts it, like when you write it for the first time, and I read it for the first time, you go, wow. It took me about 2 weeks to say, all right, I'm not going to say Lord anymore, and I'm never going to call myself a Christian. I'm not going to do this.
Right.
I want Abraham's deal. That was it.
Right. You know, in these volumes you're writing right now that are in opposition to the Whore of Babylon, the Whore of Babylon and Baal are one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
And Baal means Lord. That's just what it means. And Satan is the Lord.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious. It's amazing that you know, all these things we're talking about.
Oh, that's, you know, by the way, that's one of the corruptions we were showing that somebody had thrown up there in UT, is that Baal is a symbol for God. Strong said so.
Well, it is. Baal is the symbol of the God of Christianity.
Their God.
The Lord.
Symbol of the God of Christianity.
It is that. And then you look at something like the Bible. And, you know, we've always just said, well, Bible is based upon Biblos, and Biblos is transliteration of a Biblia, which is the Egyptian goddess where papyrus was grown, and so to name the book after Biblia, a pagan goddess, is really pretty pathetic. But it was staring us in the face all the time.
Yeah, Babel, Babylon, Babel.
Babel, which is Hebrew for Babylon, not only means to corrupt and confuse, which is exactly what they've done to Yahweh's testimony, they've corrupted it for the purpose of confusing, but that Babel is the most common of all Hebrew prepositions. Ba, it means with and in. And Bel is the is that was the name. Bel was the absolute, was the name of the Babylonian god, Bel, and it means Lord. And that here you had Bible in Babel. Satan was so in God's face. He said, I'm going to rename your testimony. I'm going to call it with me. And there it was, staring us in the face. Took us a long time to see it, but it was there all along.
I do have a question for you. I had somebody send this in. You know, Yahweh tells us on many occasions he has nothing to do with the world's leaders. So he doesn't even know them.
Right.
But
he's
going to
know them. He's going to know them in the sense of, you're going to be judged. Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't know them in a relational sense, in a positive relational sense.
Right.
You know, they put people in charge. I didn't even know them. He says, you know.
Right.
You know, and he points this stuff out on several occasions, so we know it's no accident.
Yeah, you're correct.
But in Daniel,
in a relational sense, he doesn't even know what they're doing, but he has his malacher keeping tabs on what they're doing because he's going to have his malacher.
Right.
Try to convict them, right.
Yeah, but here's the question. In Daniel 2:2, I'm sure you've probably been over this. He changes times and seasons. He dispossesses kings and raises others up. I'm fairly sure that is not what we're talking about here. He's not putting people in positions of power. You know, I mean, I guess dispossessing kings, he could have had Dode, you know, wipe out kings, you know, other kingdoms. And he could have raised Dode up. I mean, this might have been on an occasion or two, but this certainly doesn't mean he's running the political system worldwide. You know.
No, Dode is not running the political system worldwide. Now, the Torahless one is definitely going to change the times. He's going to impose Christianity. He's going to impose Sunday worship. He's going to impose Christmas and Easter and Christian holidays. And so he's going to do what Rome attempted to do, which is to mandate it worldwide that you acquiesce to Christianity. That is what he is going to do. So, for when Yahweh returns and he sets up the kingdom of Dode, Yahweh is going to have to change them back to his original plan, so that we'll be back on Shabbat and back on Pesach Matzah.
So you think that's what we're talking about here?
If you look at Dode, Yisrael at that time was practicing the Babylonian religion. And so Dode, during the time that he was king of Yisrael, had to turn back and replace the Babylonian religious practices, the Babylonian rites and holidays, Sunday worship and all that sort of thing. He had to turn it back to Yahweh's original testimony. I mean, God's constantly using Shub. Turn back, return. And so I think that you could absolutely use Dode's approach, which was the same as Hezekiah's approach, of returning back to Yahweh's original plan and away from man's plan. I mean, God's constantly saying to come to him, we have to turn around and go in the opposite direction. So to change the times, if you're Dode, you're changing him back to Yahweh. You're not changing him from Yahweh. You're changing him from the Babylonian practice back to Yahweh.
So that's what you think. You think that's what passage is about, and that makes sense. That makes sense because he's talking about seasons and times as well as kings. Yeah. So he's obviously okay.
Yeah, and look what Dode did. I mean, Dode replaced the man chosen kings. You know, so he replaced man's system. He replaced the Babylonian religion, and the kingdom of Dode, that is the millennial kingdom, prophetically, going to do exactly the same thing. Dode's not going to change them to something new. He's going to change them from what man, with the Torahless one, had insisted upon, what religions have established, because all religious artifacts and all religious individuals are going to be pulverized and buried. So we're going to return back to the seasons. It's kind of like when in Yirmiyah 31, when Yah says, you know, that he's going to renew and reaffirm his covenant. Well, that doesn't mean he's going to create a new and different one or change it. It just means that he is going to reaffirm, go right back to the original plan.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what's being conveyed. God only got one plan. Only got one family, one covenant, one Torah, one path to him, one set of mikre, only one plan. And there is absolutely no indication whatsoever that he's ever going to vary from it, and that every indication is, every statement that he makes is that he is going to uphold it, that he is trustworthy and reliable because he is dependable, because he's not going to change. You know, what did we find out when Yahweh said, you know, we're talking in Chabot, which we'll return to next week, but when he said in Chabot, you know, I'm going to stand upon my requirements. I've established my requirements. I'm going to stand on them. I'm not going to change. So then he says, so I'm going to see what he has to say about me. And then he says, because of what he has to say, you know, why would you expect me to do anything but to condemn and rebuke him? You know, God's not going to change. He's laid out his plan. He's going to honor his plan. It's a wonderful plan. And it's not just that he has articulated the plan. It's not just that to be dependable, to be reliable, to be trustworthy, he can't change the plan. It's that in this particular plan, God already facilitated it. He paid a hellacious price to enable this plan. You know, it's like if Larry, you're living there in Florida. If I donated everything I've ever made in my life, if I donated 100% of my energy and time, if I suffered enormously to enable you to live freely in Florida, and then you said, you know, I think I'm going to move to North Carolina. What did I do it for? You know, Yahweh came up with this plan. He facilitated the plan. He's the living embodiment of the plan. I mean, to expect him to say, yeah, well, what the heck, you know, that crucifixion thing and being flayed alive and going down
there. Yeah, don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
No big deal. Yeah. Come up with it. You know, if you've got a better plan, you got a different plan, that's okay with me. It's really irrelevant that I did all of that.
You know, with a creator reaching down into this dimension that he created that has time involved and so forth, you know, going back to what we had discussed, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, 14.7 billion years is 6 days, and things are moving
right.
So fast you couldn't see them, you know, from
right.
That you have to diminish and come within that time in order to view the time. And that makes total sense. Now, having said that, I think the reason for, you know, the crucifixion and the going to Sheol and all that was to draw attention to the fact, hey, buddy, there really is a creator.
Yeah, you know, I think that the crucifixion, and it really hadn't dawned on me until really now. But first of all we were all from God's perspective, this was Passover. Now, the Passover lamb is not crucified. So why crucifixion as the means of sacrificing the body? Why crucifixion as the means of sacrificing the body as part of Pesach? Why do that?
I don't know. Other than very public. You know,
it's not a quick slaughter. So, I mean,
that's not it either.
No?
That's not it either. It just dawned on me, so I'm not claiming I'm right here. I'm just going to give you what the insight that has welled up within me.
Okay.
What is the worst, from God's perspective, of all of human history, what's the single worst civilization that has ever existed?
Rome.
Imperial Rome, okay. And what did Imperial Rome grow into?
The Catholic Church.
Christianity, Roman Catholicism. And does John would say that is the beast that treads upon the whole world?
Yes.
And doesn't he specifically identify that beast with Babylon, the whore of Babylon, the mother of Harlem?
Absolutely.
And
no question about it.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
What we've been going right. over, the whore of religion.
What form of killing is most synonymous with
crucifixion?
Rome?
There you go. Yep.
You know, it is. in Roman Catholicism, man all but killed God. Did away with him.
Mm-hmm.
Tortures him. Mutilates him.
They do kill him.
They do.
According to them.
Yeah, in fact, the symbol of the Roman Catholic Church is their crucifix.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People hanging on their cross.
So,
they're very
God
proud.
God allowed the worst beast in all of humanity, the most satanic, demonic influence on humankind, to perpetrate the death of the sacrificial lamb. And it was beyond that, too, in that the implement that he was hung on, what is it most prescriptive of?
A wooden tree, upright pole?
Upright pole. Upright is the idol, and the upright pole of the tabernacle, which enlarges and secures the Yahweh's home. But it is also, you know, when on Pesach, isn't it the upright pillars and the lentils that the blood is to be sprinkled on that forms the doorway to heaven?
Well, yeah, clearly, yeah, that's the doorway. Yeah, we know that.
Doorway.
I mean, that's the
symbol.
So the
implement itself is an upright pole. It is synonymous with the doorway to heaven. So it is the upright pole of the that secures and enlarges the tabernacle, which is the home of Yahweh. In addition to that, is synonymous with the very instructions of what would happen on Pesach. But it was the means of death synonymous with the ultimate beast, the very thing that God is saving us from. Christianity.
It makes sense to me.
So, you know, it's every aspect of his plan. It's the details are there. It's why, and we have a small disagreement on this, JB, but it's the reason why I think that we are able as covenant members to disagree on the timing of Pesach and Matzah. Because Yosha wanted to celebrate Pesach with those he loved, with his disciples, to set the example of how you observe Pesach and also be the Pesach lamb. And the only way for him to do that is for it to begin on the at sundown on the 13th day and continue through what we would call the 14th day. And he ate matzah during the process so that it was possible for him to celebrate, observe Pesach as one who was observing what Yahweh, celebrating what Yahweh had invited us to do, setting the example, and yet himself serve as the Pesach lamb. It was designed to accommodate that. Now, that's brilliant in terms of the timing. And it was all established specifically to enable that. And then I think that even the details of why, for example, this year we have a difference in the family as to when we should celebrate Pesach versus essentially full moon versus the other. And I'm convinced that there's a reason that there's no specificity, that the reason there is no description of that is it's the renewed light on the moon, based not on not specified if it's astronomical or if it's observational. Both are observational, by the way. Or if it how much light has to be on the moon's surface? Does it have to the light have to be renewing prior to the sunset? Which, you know, we have a different time. Hebrew, the day begins at sunset, and on our current calendars worldwide, the day begins at 12:01 in the middle of the night. So, you know, if you have renewed light on the moon, but it's after sunset, then that can't be the day. You know, so it has to occur before the sunset. But he doesn't specify it that way. You just have to think it through. And he never once says that it's the sunset nearest the vernal equinox. But he says that, you know, it's the time that barley is abeeb and the bloom, the blue bloom on the flax, that's the time that this is going to occur, and it's the renewal of the light of the moon that's coterminous with that. Well, to have that be consistent, you know, it's going to be the renewed light on the moon that's closest to the spring equinox. But he doesn't provide specificity for a reason.
He doesn't say what strand of barley, what location that barley has to be grown in.
Right. Doesn't say where you look for the moon. It doesn't say what happens if the sky is if it's cloudy that day.
Yeah. What if there's a thunderstorm?
No provision for that. Right. And by saying to Hezekiah, we're going to be a couple of weeks late. Is that okay with you? Absolutely. We're going to celebrate it a couple of weeks longer. Is that okay with you? Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. It's not about the day. I mean, you know, we are so fixated on what day it was. You know, what day was he born? Well, he wasn't born. There's no specificity on the day. Don't get tied up on that. That's not the issue.
It's not
how you observe it. It's not what you do. It's not what day you do it on. Has to do. What is the message? What is being offered? What is expected? What is this? What's an invitation? To what? To be called out. To meet with God. It's based on Kara. To read and recite his testimony. It's an invitation.
For the purposes of understanding. For the purpose.
Right. For the purpose of understanding.
Instead of parroting. Parroting is the purpose in a church. I mean, it's for the purpose of parroting these words that were screwed up.
I must say a thousand times that the means to know him is to listen to what he has to say, to observe his teaching, his guidance.
Chew on it. Think about it.
Think about it, yeah, to make the necessary connections so that you understand. And
I do have a question before we go to. I do another one.
Okay.
I forgot. What was the name of the god of fortune in Yashayah? They're always trying to say it was Gad was his name, which is totally
true. There is a god named Gad that was the god of fortune.
Huh? Oh. Okay.
Yeah. So it's just
got another name.
The Canaanite god was El.
Yeah, sure.
That's just there. Yahweh has a name. He has several titles. He has one name. So long as you know his name, share his name, acknowledge his name, understand his name, love his name, reveal his name, acknowledge his name, and you understand his titles. God is an important title, particularly if you're the real one. So is Father. So those are the fact is that Hasatan is not creative. All he does is counterfeit. So the things that he's going to do is he's going to establish gods by the names that counterfeits what Yahweh has to offer. And one of the things I was always frustrated about is, in trying to tie, we've probably all read the Two Babylons, Alexander Hislop's book, The Two Babylons, and he spends an inordinate amount of that book trying to show the transition from Tammuz, for example, and how Tammuz was the child of Nimrod and Semiramis, and then how Tammuz became Osiris, and how Osiris became Dionysus, and how Dionysus became Bacchus, and then he goes through also the queens of heavens and mothers of God and all that kind of stuff. And what my problem with all that was is that they all had different characteristics, different names, different parents. There was no smooth transition and consistency between them. And I was always frustrated because I wanted to be able to show people that Tammuz was the same god as Osiris, was the same god as Dionysus, was the same god as Bacchus, was the same god as the Christian Jesus. And you really can't do that because their characteristics, their lineage, and their rites that surround them are all somewhat different. And it just dawned on me the other day as to why that's the case. The more confusing it is, the better it is for Satan.
Oh, sure.
Satan.
It's the same ripoff every time, too. Bodies in the ground, 3 days. They get up and dead bodies walk, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
but
really.
The more different names and the more difficult it is to pin it all down and say, well, this is the false one, the better it is for Satan. You know, he doesn't care what name you choose to worship him. He doesn't care if you call him Allah. He doesn't care if you call him Jesus. He doesn't care if you call him Buddha. He doesn't care if you call him Dionysus or Bacchus or Osiris or Ra. He doesn't care.
He doesn't care.
It is absolutely meaningless to him what you call him, so long as you are fooled by him and worship him. And so the migration of names, for example, the Gratia are not an absolute duplication of the charities. There's some differences between them. But it doesn't matter. That's the whole purpose of Satan, is to confuse. If they were all exactly the same going through history, then it wouldn't be confusing. It's confusing. Just like, if you were to say, all right, the Christian Jesus is modeled after Dionysus. That's true. Is there, and about 90% of what was said about Dionysus is reflected in the Christian Jesus, but not 100%. You got to have some confusion in there, otherwise it wouldn't be beguiling.
But it doesn't matter, as long as I take you off the road to another road.
Correct.
You have it.
Yeah, right. So long as I've got a counterfeit that is...
You'll accept.
Right.
If you don't like this model, let me give you this one.
Right. I don't care which model you choose. And I've got a religion out there for the insanely stupid. It's called Islam. I've got one for the insanely moronic. It's called Scientology. I've got one there for the egotistical. It's called secular humanism. I've got one for the comatose. It's called Christianity. You name it. I've got one for you. And the edicts of those religions are all designed to distract. I mean, what's the biggest thing about Christianity? It doesn't want you to be promiscuous. And so, they spend all their time on being opposed to homosexuality
being approved.
and being approved.
Just being approved, really, more than anything.
Isn't the most sexually promiscuous person presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, Dot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
So I would tell you, when Yahweh created Chawa for the benefit of Adam, do you think that he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make this woman really unattractive so that man won't be bothered by her at all? Jeez, I'm going to make her really unattractive. Do you think I'm going to make her really attractive? Because I want Adam to have a good time. God's not bothered by the things that bother religious individuals.
I did a post. I said, can you imagine? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I called it, I did it like a Jeopardy,
mm-hmm.
Stupid religions for 1,000. This, the religion, based on forgiving the most heinous crimes you can imagine, loving everybody, no matter what adult jerk or murderous animal they are, and advancing sexual prudism. Can you imagine? I mean, you're outside the Torah on everything, on absolutely everything. You're missing the mark. You live in total sin when you walk in a church, right? And because you have this enormous faith in the unknown, you're a sexual prude. I like that. Fruitism.
Right,
sexual fruitism. You're the one that came up with it. You know, and you forgive anybody, no matter what a animal, jerk, vile, disgusting human being they are, and you love everyone because your judgment stinks.
Imagine having a daughter and having a guy not only rape your daughter, but kill your son. And torture your
you
wife.
Go forgive him.
And you not only forgive him, but love him.
Oh, yeah. Pray for him and all that shit. Yeah, no, I know. I watch these whodunit shows. By the way, I saw my daughter on one of them. She was having an acting bit in one of them the other day.
Oh,
I was watching it. Yeah, it is funny. She didn't tell me she was on it. But, it was called Murder Comes to Town. She was playing this wife. She didn't do the murder, but they just didn't know if she did it or not. But, you know, the thing of it is, you know, you start thinking about it. Of course, we think of it in terms like that now. You know, think about such a stupid belief system or ethos, I guess. You know, I mean, really. Let's see, I've got faith in the unknown, I believe real hard, I forgive everyone, I love everyone, and I'm sexually uptight, and God will love me for that. I mean, this is stupid on its face. It's just stupid.
Yeah, it is.
I know it is. Yeah.
Why would God?
Damn dumb.
If God was concerned about that, why didn't it make the top 10 list?
It didn't make any list at all. It doesn't even count. You know,
I'm quite certain it didn't make any list. And even the list where he goes through and says, "Okay, these are sexual perversions," and really, I advise against incest and advise against homosexuality, and I'm advising against bestiality. And he's got the list of things. He says, "You know, this is not good. This is not good behavior." Promiscuity doesn't make a list. Let me make that list.
No, I know. And yet people fall off, you know, they base a good bit of what they believe on just that. I mean, I told you, I was watching one of those one day where the religious woman, they were, you know, she was somebody that would just stop and pray for you at the drop of a hat. You know, this is how she was described, no matter what.
Yeah.
And her husband's brother comes and lives with them. They end up liking each other. And she goes, "Well, you know, I can't get a divorce, but if he were dead." And so he kills her husband. And every time they went to these church, there was three different church people they went to. And they said, "Now, you know, she kind of set the murder up, but she didn't have sex with him." You know, I mean, they all made this big point. And I was going, let's see. She had one brother murder the other brother so she could get rid of him, but she didn't have sex with him. Wow, what a lovely person. What a lovely person. Wow. Ain't that grand?
The stories I'm reading now, that I have a son that goes to a Christian university. He's in his last 6 months of a doctorate program there, and they're having a real problem with sexual abuse, and the football players are abusing the co-eds, raping them and sexually abusing them, and the school is rallying around the football players and is
of course.
And then, you know, media is having a field day. They say, "Wait, but this must be a Christian university," and universally now they are harassing the victims and protecting the perpetrators.
Well, of course.
And not a single person has come out and said, "You know, this reminds me of the Roman Catholic Church," doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Harassing the victims and rallying around and protecting the priests.
And Penn State.
Yeah, in fact, the articles on Penn State are that because now there's a lawsuit where Penn State decided they would sue the insurance company to have the insurance company cough up the $60 million they gave to the victims. And in that lawsuit, the testimony has come out that that Joe Paterno, mm-hmm.
Back
absolutely, unequivocally knew and deliberately hid the knowledge of Sandusky being a pedophile.
Yeah, I read that, yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, so
what's new, right? And yet
yeah, human institutions, academic institutions. You know that one out of every four women that attends an American university is sexually abused during the 4 years she's there.
Are you kidding?
No. You know, this is supposed to be the bastion of enlightenment and morality in our society. One out of four.
Well, you know, I mean, since I've come to know the truth, what I have come to know is that there's nothing really worth learning, being taught at a university. I mean, really, not in a lot.
Yeah, I think that the sciences are a worthy endeavor.
Well, that's what all my kids did. But in fact, my daughter's in her doctorate program.
You know, I got
program.
A business degree. There's some things that I learned in business that were probably somewhat useful. You know, how to read a financial statement and balance sheet and to do financial forecasting and that sort of thing. I mean, there's some things that I learned that had some value. But I can tell you that the indoctrination that goes along with it is so counterproductive that I think the value is offset. Indoctrination is just horrific. You know, you watch it today in the political spectrum where I think it's about 80% of those who are under 30 years old and have received a college degree are voting for a communist.
Yeah. Oh, really? They're going to give one to Bernie, huh?
Yeah. really?
I didn't
every
know.
Time a nation has attempted such, you know, you look at what happened in Russia, 40 million people killed. Yeah. You look at China, 40 million people
60
killed.
Million. 60 million.
Yeah, some say 60 million, yeah. And you look at Cambodia. Look what happened. Look what happened in Vietnam. Look at, compare North Korea to South Korea. Compare East Germany to West Germany. And
so
you know,
if you can see that in communism and you can see the countries that are Muslim, why can't you connect the dots?
Correct.
This is not the system we should copy.
Right.
It's pretty clear that, of course, now, I mean, we don't even have capitalism. We got crony capitalism. And you know, that's something I'm totally against. But it doesn't matter,
fascism,
because in the end, they're all capitalistic.
Capitalism are all the same thing.
Socialism,
we used to have free enterprise. We don't have free enterprise anymore. America
right.
is far more socialistic than it is free enterprise.
Well, you know,
America is more free enterprise than we are.
Clear. You know, no, I know. We're more red than red China. I mean, just look at the taxes.
Yeah, economically, in terms of our tax goes, redistribution of wealth, we are more communist in our economic policy than they are. They are communist in terms of their politics, and we are communist in terms of our economics.
An appeal for Bernie is just to forgive my college debt. But if I want to go to school and I expect to return,
and of course, and rob the 1%. Everything is the reason that you don't have a mansion and a fancy car and recreational vehicles is the 1%. And if we just simply rob the 1%, you will all have everything that you wanted, and we'll deprive them, and the world will be wonderful. That's all you need to do.
Yeah, sure, that always works out.
1% and everything, everything will be great. You know, I was working in my house the other day, and he says, you know, we could resolve the debt if we sold all the public land. I said, oh, really? So let's just say
we already have. You're right.
The average American, has $250 in savings. So the average American isn't going to buy any of your public land. Now, so who's going to buy it?
China.
Okay. So let's just say the Chinese are going to buy it. So how much public land do you think the Chinese are going to buy?
They're trying to develop it. They don't want it.
No, I don't even think they sell it to them now. They just say, here, take this.
A trillion? Yeah, a trillion. You know, the Chinese have less than $1 trillion in T-bills. Are they going to – let's have them trade in $1 trillion in T-bills for federal land. Okay, now your federal debt goes from $20 trillion to $19
trillion.
The OPECers have collectively have about $1 trillion in T-bills. So, okay, let's have them trade it for a for some government land. Now you've gone from 19 trillion to 18 trillion. Okay, let's get the rest of the world to...
No, you're doing the math is your problem here.
So let's just say that you've got $5 trillion to buy all of the government's land, and now you've got $15 trillion in debt, with the government adding $1 trillion every year. In other words, you're going further in the wrong direction as you're engaged in the process. There is no resolution here.
When I took economics in college, the guy stood up and he said, okay, tomorrow everybody gets $1 million. And everybody went, wow, great, everybody gets $1 million. And then he says, but then, of course, I walked out to my front steps and I noticed that my paper wasn't there. So I called down the street to Charlie and I said, Charlie, your boy didn't deliver the paper.
Sure, he's got $1 million.
He's a millionaire now. What did he need to deliver that paper? That ain't the solution, guys. I mean, it's that so simple.
Right.
We're
not
going to show
everybody
equal.
Why would
you make anybody better?
He's a millionaire now.
Yeah. So
my pool's not clean. Well, I want to do
that.
Well, I need gas for my car. Well, there's nobody working at the gas station. He's a millionaire.
So give me about 2 weeks, and all the people who have the money will be the ambitious ones who go out there and say, okay, I'll do it for you for $500,000. Bingo.
Yeah,
and we're right back together. The rest of them are sitting around going counting their money, or they can't get anything done for themselves.
Can't go to the market,
so
but I need
not
service. Well, there's nobody
ever
working in the market. Nobody knows truck drivers. Nobody works in the market. Everybody's, what are you going to spend your money on?
Yeah. So, you know, it'd take a month and everything would be right back the same way it is.
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't work.
Yeah, so that's not a mandate.
All right, fellas, well, we didn't get to Habakkuk, but I think we had a fun discussion about what it's like to be in the covenant.
Mm-hmm. Well done.
Yeah,
I enjoyed hearing it. And there is a lot of things that we've discussed that no one else discusses ever. And there's things we've uncovered nobody else uncovers. There's truths we've laid out there that nobody else lays out there. And we're doing something that hasn't been done in thousands of years. And we are such a small group. It's pathetic. It's pathetic.
And it's amazing how obvious all these things were.
Before you go away, Terry was just asking me, are we doing 9 o'clock on Monday, or are we just waiting until next week?
No, 9 o'clock on Monday, I think, is what Scott does.
Okay.
9 o'clock for you, noon for me on Monday.
Okay.
And we'll pick
Greg
up on
get up
anymore. On Chabaok.
Ten or something like that.
Yeah, he's West Coast, I'm East Coast. We'll just begin with the opening the second chapter of Chabaok. We'd gotten to 5 or 6, but we'll just retrace our steps back to Chabaok 2:1 and make our way through it.
No problem. All right, 9 o'clock on Monday. I'll be there.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, JB.
No, I appreciate it, you guys.
Good night.
Good night, Phyllis. Bye-bye.